It's Wednesday, October 12th, 2011, and you're listening to episode 247 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 55 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name's John.
My name's Pat.
My name's Adam.
Yes, Adam is joining us today because Chad can never not be on Kicked in the Dice Bags. He had to drag somebody from Kicked in the Dice Bags over to Fear the Boot just to keep himself at home.
You know, Adam, last episode, Keith and I failed to take over the show and talk about Superman for an hour. Maybe you and I could take care of this.
We're going to take over the show and talk about getting our dropship blown up.
We are actually going to talk about that. There are two things.
Oh, God, it hurts.
Oh, we were going
much.
To talk about that, whether you planned to talk about that or not.
Well, yeah, you blew it up.
I've got three.
My favorite part of that whole thing, we're playing Battletech. Dan blows up our dropship that was so hard fought over, that we bled for, that we cried for, that we earned. Next game, he blows it up. And then after it was all done, we kind of talk about it a little bit. And John's going upstairs. And Dan's like, hey, John, can you give me a glass of water? No. You.
No, this is even worse than that. I go, does anyone want anything to drink? Because our role play was proceeding into drinking away the misery. And I wanted to bring down alcohol. And Dan goes, yeah, I'll have a water. And I go, I didn't ask you, asshole. I bought him a water, but brought him one, but I didn't want to.
Yeah, no, I didn't get anything else. All right, so three announcements. Two of them will hit quickly. One of them, well, they'll all be quick, but one of them's new news. First off, I want to remind everyone we have the Gnome Stew charity auction for March of Dimes still going on. It involves a whole bunch of games are given away, some opportunities to sort of pilot some articles over there, and also some custom art of both a character portrait and a group portrait by Christopher Reach. The second thing is we are still getting the show transcripts done. So if you were interested in those, either to harangue us for something we said or for hearing impaired friends or for whatever.
You just, or if you'd like to consume a Fear the Boot episode in 10 minutes instead of an hour.
Yeah, then you can find that in the show notes. Last off, the Fear the Con site is live. As of this episode.
What?
As of this episode dropping, you can go to fearthecon.com or find the link in the show notes. And you can start signing up, getting tickets, creating games, all that good stuff. I also want to announce that there is one game in one slot that I'm going to do on a lottery system. This was requested by a couple people last year. One of the games I do of Gingers Have No Souls, which will be run on the D. Wayne system. I will be taking my entrance by lottery. I will close that lottery out in plenty of time for folks to create or move to other games. We will probably end that, like, at the worst by the end of the calendar year, so people still have from January through May to do other things with that time slot.
Who's throwing down? Who's ready to declare what games they're running? Or at least some games that they're running right
probably
now.
Probably two Star Treks and two Gingers Have No Souls.
Awesome.
At least two Blood Moon Goblins. I usually run one game a day. I might amp it up this time, but Goblins all day.
I'm going to try and run three. I'm going to run one Inception, one Silent Memories, and then I'm kicking around this idea for a sort of combination Twin Peaks, Call of Cthulhu, Dark City amalgam weirdness game. It's still like percolating right now. I made no guarantees about that one, but it's something I kind of want to try.
At this point, I'll likely be running a One Knights of Rainsborough game and probably something else, but we'll see how many games Dan grabs me for the D. Wayne system. That'll determine how much I run, because I want to play in
what
stuff.
What is
too.
The D. Wayne system?
The D. Wayne system.
I know what it is, but tell me.
The D. Wayne system means that whoever is in the game can bribe me with money or comics or whatever they want, or just flatter me.
Because you resolve combat ambiguity, yes, and randomness, yep, and social results and everything.
I am the D-Wade system.
You are not the DM so much as you're the dice.
Yes, that is correct. Anytime someone says, like, I try to pick the lock, I just say, Wayne. And Wayne says this is what the result was. Anywhere from critical success to critical failure and all points between.
You know, this is a diceless system I can get behind, even though I categorically hate them. It's Wayne. What's he going to do? Right. Be a dick? No.
This is the greatest idea since Monostat, guys. Really, I think you hit on something.
Wayne's monostat is very high.
Yeah, market it. Yeah. Bottle Wayne and put him in boxes and sell him across the country.
I don't want a bottle of anything involving Wayne.
It's just going to be
just putting that out there.
It's just going to be a PDF that has Wayne's cell phone number on it.
Anytime, day or night.
Bob Arns to make the Wayne bot. It'll be like a chat bot based.
That'd be really easy. Totally, I like Superman.
We'll totally open source it so other people can utilize the D. Wayne system, which is Wayne's cell phone number, in their games as well. Yeah. So, yeah.
There you go.
Since we're talking about me, I have a minor bitch that I noticed today.
Dude, you've been married.
Okay. Hold on.
I said
okay.
A minor one.
Hold on. So wait.
Go ahead.
Adam, what's your games?
I'm for sure going to run a sequel to the Innocence game that I ran last year. I'm considering running a sequel to the Pirates game that I ran, but I'm still not sure yet. And I know I'm going to run one more. I just don't know what the hell I'm going to run. So that's it.
Okay. So I've talked about the custom things I used to have on the show before. These are things that I spent like $30 for, maybe $35. You know, it's a full mold. You mold them to your teeth. They're an exact fit. They fit perfectly. I'm walking through Walgreens the other day. I look over and here are custom fangs with the full mold. Almost exactly like what I had back then, except now they're like $2.99. I mean, this is, yeah.
Still $2 too much.
15 years later or so, but something I once paid like $30-$35 for. Yeah, you can just get them now for $2.99.
You know how much gas is in the dystopian future of the original Deus Ex game? Like $3.50. It's like, oh, I hate this.
Well, the Twin Towers are still... Well,
actually, they're not.
They patched the Twin Towers out of the original Deus Ex.
No, they didn't. They were never loaded in there because the file was too big.
Oh, really?
So instead of having the full New York skyline, they have half of it and the other half mirrored, and the Twin Towers is not in it. And in
conspiracy.
An interview, they said, in the universe of Deus Ex, the Twin Towers were taken down by an undescribed terrorist attack. So
neat.
We can,
I mean,
we figured out what that one was, yeah.
In the context of the game, that's really cool.
Yeah, they took down all of Deus Ex's online marketing after 9/11 because, hey guys, a terrorist attack happened on New York and we tolerated an increasing security state that eventually destroyed our democracy. Yeah! Where does the fiction start?
At the $3.50 gas.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
Wow.
I'm not going anywhere near that discussion.
Okay. Hey, dude, we'll save that for the next Kick in the Dice fight. It's cool. We'll go there.
Okay, so we are going to start off with an update on our game. Obviously, it does involve Adam. We brought him on here for a different subject, the main topic.
Boobies.
But there are two things we're going to talk about from an update on our game. I'll go ahead and start off by letting these guys rant about their defeat.
I thought it was awesome.
Okay, so let me tell you what Dan's idea of a light lance is. Guys, you're going to face light resistance. You know, there's an assault mech there, and two tanks that have PPCs and 50 points of front armor, but there's a locust in there, too, so it's a light lance. You can land your dropship right up in there. It won't have any problems.
I was kind of wondering why we were going up against a heavy command lance.
Called them a mixed lance. I never called... In fact, when you
were... You said light resistance.
Yeah.
And when you guys were doing your die rolls, the very first thing that I told you was you know there's a victor in their lance.
Okay. A victor that can be in a lance that doesn't have two PPC tanks, two more meds, and I think actually one heavy and one med, and the locust. But hey, there was a locust.
And when it was all over, there was still a locust.
Yeah, and when it was all over, there were still...
For non-Battletech people, a victor is an incredibly heavy, powerful mech, and a locust is a very light mech. Yes.
But we don't actually blame Dan, and that's what hurts. Usually when you screw up, you say, okay, the GM effed me here, there, and there. This time, as we watched our dropship melt away in three rounds, I was like, yeah, that happened.
Yeah.
And it didn't
happen. We all agreed ahead of time. This is a really cool plan. They won't see this coming.
Plan.
And
solid
then as soon as we landed, we're all like, oh.
It wasn't as soon as we landed that I knew we were about to lose $10 million. It was as soon as round one's firing was over that I knew we were about to lose $10 million.
Well, to back up explain this a little bit, in the first game of this campaign, they did a really unlikely and very successful raid where they took what's called a dropship, which is a large ship used to transport mechs and tanks and people.
Oh, and it's more valuable than all our mechs combined.
Yeah, and they managed to steal one.
No, that one isn't anymore.
By boarding from somebody else. In this game, they decided to land it right next to an enemy garrison, and the enemy garrison, realizing they had help, but it was too far away, decided to do a Hail Mary, and instead of fighting them, attacked their ship. Thinking if we destroy it, we've left them stranded, they'll have no choice but to surrender eventually.
Yeah. And keep in mind, these ships aren't like, this isn't a cardboard box. The one side of this thing has more armor than my mech does.
Yeah.
It has far more firepower than any of our mechs.
Unfortunately, your mech can be missed in theory. The side of this dropship cannot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it succeeded. They did destroy it, and this led to a broader discussion, and this is actually what I want to talk about here. It's not, per se, a gaming story, but let's use this as context for defeat. After this happened, there were a couple things that I noticed. The first and most immediate one was there was a sudden drop in energy around the table.
Yeah, is like everybody deflated.
Yeah, and Beth pointed out, she's like, you know, I know that defeat is a real part of life, but that's the problem with it. It's part of real life. I came here to escape from that, et cetera, et cetera. But you had a different outlook on this.
My outlook is that the tendency is that when you play role-playing games, I'm speaking very broadly here, it's mounting successes. You know, you beat this challenge, you meet this challenge, could be combat, or it could be a role-playing thing, or it could be puzzles, or it could be whatever your shtick is in role-playing. It's just success after success after success. And I don't mean that these are handed to you on a silver platter, but you overcome the challenge, you defeat the enemy, you win, and it's difficult, and it's earned, and it feels good, but it's this constant build of win, 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 up and up and up. And I see that in every single role-playing game I play, no matter if I'm running the game, because that happened a lot in the last one, or if somebody else is running it, or if I'm playing it a con game. It's just like these series of success. And I like the idea of these nebulous constant heroes of the player party. I don't mean necessarily our mech warriors, but the concept of players being handed a defeat, a real tangible defeat that wasn't a setup. It wasn't a BS. Dan didn't plan this. You didn't even necessarily want it. You just ran it straight up.
Right.
And you didn't hand us the defeat. It's our fault. We defeated ourselves. It was totally legitimate. And we got brought down a peg.
Not only did we lose, we hoisted the white flag, yes, which is in gaming 10 times worse than death.
Yeah. We hoisted the white flag against guys who were totally shot to Swiss cheese. No one else had any real damage.
And we could have defeated everyone that was left there, but
we saw
their friends were on the way there.
Their friends were on the way there. We had no, our exit strategy had disintegrated, literally disintegrated. And we saw the big picture. It's just like, we can't win. And they offered us terms of surrender, which is you keep your mechs, you keep your lives. We're not even going to torture you, capture you. Prisoners, we're not going to take anything away. We just want you to leave.
Yeah.
We win, you leave.
And what we gave them in exchange was not, in fact, eviscerating the mechs that we were 20 seconds away from destroying uniformly.
Yeah, basically the thing is that we lose, we walk off the field, everybody gets to live. So we made the decision to take it. And the air was let out of the room. It was like this real tangible defeat. And the reaction, the in-character reactions to this were so real. And they were so in character. And they were so awesome. Everybody just gave up. They were defeated. And we were defeated. And we went drinking. And because we, not because we're the heroes and we like getting drunk because it's fun to get drunk in character. No, we got drunk because we wanted to stop feeling.
This is like the type of drinking you do after you get dumped.
Yes. It was that's exactly it.
Getting dumped was worse than losing a dropship. Well, no, it's not. Other way around. To a mech warrior, your dropship is better than your girlfriend.
Yeah, when you're a mech warrior, bitches be falling out of the sky.
Yeah, and so does your dropship.
You know, I put a lot of thought towards this after the fact, too. And
I absolutely loved it.
I like dealing with failure. I like dealing with setbacks in game. If we would have ended the game right there at that point in that night, I would have been dreading the next session.
Right.
Because for me, I'm realizing something about myself as we play through. I love dealing with failure. I don't want it to happen at the beginning of the campaign because that sets the tone.
Yeah, we had major successes before we
made...
only got to losing the damn thing because we picked it up in the first place.
Yeah, it was hubris.
We created a failure for ourselves before...
Yeah. It was poor tactics.
Before we moved
it was
into
an
a
excellent
success.
Excellent plan. And then everyone agreed on.
We agreed on it.
It was, I'm sorry I voted
hubris.
This plan.
You were Mr. Olaf. It's going to be great if they shoot at the dropship. It has so much armor. And I was like, no.
No, you did not say
yes,
that.
Yes, I did.
Maybe a little.
So, yeah, okay.
But everybody thought it was a great plan.
Here's the thing that I would say is their lance really was mismatched, was honestly not the greatest lance in the world. They were designed to do one thing and one thing only, which was defend. And you guys chose to take them face to face on their territory. If you had come in from the far side of the map and taken them in a drawn out battle, you'd have slaughtered them wholesale. Landing in their face was the one and only place you could put yourselves where they actually had attack.
We should
advantage.
Have, our objective was to destroy the objective. We should have landed the ship on the objective.
Well, no, we
and then
have.
Take it off and gone home.
Correct me if I'm wrong, GM, but I think if we just raise the communications complex and leave, we all pat ourselves on the back. Maybe we even collect on the contract, but Anna survives because it's a mile underground in a concrete.
Well, yeah, there's
container.
The, I mean, I hate to belittle Dan's plot like this, but the MacGuffin was in a bunker a mile underground. And
it is my assessment that the MacGuffin would have physically survived the destruction of the facility on top of it.
But we didn't know that.
No, we didn't know that.
We would have been all high fives.
Actually, in Battletech, there are structural rules to see what happens to a basement, and I would have used them.
Okay.
It is not impenetrable. I did not have it in a plot safe room.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that I think if we dug a basement 50 feet under this house and blew up this house, a box in it would not be hurt.
No, probably not. But once again, I would have used ferro rolls and things like that to see what happens to it. Because it also is highly sensitive. It is buried well, but it is also highly sensitive.
That's true.
So the sheer seismics of having a whole building come down on around it, exploding and blowing, I mean, that would have alone really posed a real threat.
Unfortunately, the other shoe on that problem is that, they were going down and they just blew up what was apparently a civilian building, and now they have no way of retrieving proof that it was housing a secret weapon. Yep. We need 5 blindfolds and 5 rifles.
The very last second when our dropship was getting ready to blow up, that's when I made the realization, hey, my character has a wife on there, and I ordered the evacuation of everyone on the dropship. Everyone thankfully got out fine. On the way back home, I was telling Chad, if I hadn't thought to do that and the character would have died at that point, I would have been done with my character. I was going through my mind, my character was the son of the person who ran the company. He was
Of ordered his death.
Yeah. In the previous
mission. Not his fault.
Yeah,
previous,
not his fault, but
previous mission,
sort of kind of.
He was tricked or prodded into killing his own father with a order of artillery on him. He goes on the next mission. If his wife would have died on that mission.
And loses a dropship named after his father.
Exactly.
That's the last time we name anything Benjamin. Was that you, Pat? Nathan? Yeah. Okay.
At that point.
No, that's right. Wayne is Benjamin.
Yeah. At that point, that would not be a character I would want to play anymore. Yeah. Not that he couldn't be an interesting character, but it's not one I think I could play anymore at that point.
Or would even want to play.
And I couldn't think of any reason in character that after those setbacks both in a row, he would ever keep doing this.
And this is where the documents that I keep for a game actually came in very useful, because I realized that while it was a fair and reasonable end, and given the fact that a mercenary game is about the business, so you can lose a mission and the business still goes on, given the emotions around the tables, like, I cannot end the game here. So it's like, okay,
even said that, too, something to that effect.
And our previous sessions had been strictly about getting this dropship. Yeah. That was our big victory, and it just blew up in front of us.
That's
part of it.
When I offered you guys these contracts, I knew that there were multiple approaches you could take to winning the goals. As a result, I had already kind of pre-written, well, if they take the max, here's what happens. If they decide to do a run on foot and try to do more of a subterfuge sabotage things, here's the way it's going to go down.
Yeah, and we talked about it, and that was something we all kind of wanted to do. But none of us could come up with a single reason in character our characters would do that.
Well, worse than that, we were playing a game of paper, rock, scissors with Lau, which is, screw them up with your mechs. Do not try to outspy them.
I had written into the plot that if they choose to take a certain method, that there is a group within the Liao forces that disagrees with what's going on for their own reasons and would actually offer sort of some kind of under the table help. And so these guys went back after getting captured. They went to the city of Northridge, which was nearby. And most of the group was getting hammered, I think, going to a strip club or something like that. Chad's character, who's a curate, very Bushido focused, was like, no, the mission's not over. I have to figure this out. It's like, boom, I flipped my notes to the second page and said, okay. Chad gets picked up by this Liao group who basically says, we can help you.
Mm-hmm.
We can help you do this a different way. And all of a sudden now there's new hope.
Yeah.
There's a new way to success where, yes, the dropship's still destroyed. You're not, in all likelihood, getting it or even its salvage back. But
no, we're taking over the planet.
You guys still...
People still don't believe me that we can do this.
You still have a visible way forward. And that quickly puts some energy back at the table. Mm-hmm. And we have not resolved it. The game's not over. The plot is still in progress.
I'm in a position to destroy it. I don't think this thing survives next Sunday. But yeah, the plot's still in progress.
Yeah, I don't think it will either, in all likelihood. But nonetheless, the point is that we were able to leave, even though the plot was unresolved, on a very, very different emotional level.
Dan posted one of his notes before about A Skies of Glass game. We were far past The Skies of Glass game. This was the first game I ever played in. So I went out there and I looked at this note, and it looked nothing like what we actually did in that session.
Dude, that's a gaming.
Yeah. In most of my games, I've talked about this what's really going on document, and I did post an example from A Skies of Glass game, where that's where I start with, is the hidden plot that the players are working their way into. I do not yet have one for this game, simply because, being a mercenaries game, at this point, things are still fairly episodic. I'm still trying to feel out what the group's general current is. I will eventually come up with larger macro plots that may get a what's really going on document, but I don't need one yet.
Well, the War of 3039 will provide one of those rather neatly.
Yeah, in about 18 months. The group template?
Yeah, we're going through 4 months per mission.
Oh, yeah. It'll happen fast.
Okay.
The group template was done verbally. We did not do a written one, but we did do a verbal one and made sure we covered everything that was on there. The third thing I had was from each of the players, I asked for character write-up. It was about one page in length, and I requested a couple things. Background, personality, and in there had to be...
five generations of family.
Chad did
and
give me...
And Chad Weeboo wanking about his Jiraiden Bushido warrior.
But
Weeboo.
I did request...
You had to be unemployed for that week.
Interconnectedness with the other players, and also plot hooks that I could use in the game, and I'll come back to that. The fourth thing is I have a spreadsheet of NPCs that describes them in brief that I can use for reference just to keep them distinct. I have a spreadsheet of unit resources. Now, this is unique to Battletech because I need to keep track of their contracts, their money, their spare parts.
Dropship.
No, that's just an empty document.
Yeah.
It's a blank piece of paper that he set on fire and he blows the ashes in her face every game.
The sixth thing is...
Goddamn dropship.
By the way, Alex, have fun with this transcript. The sixth thing is the PC plot hooks. Because with each of your backgrounds, I asked for plot hooks I use in the game, but I wanted those in a quick reference sort of setup. So as I'm writing the plots, I can skim through those and see, is there an obvious way I could have a person from Wayne's past, or I could have an opening that Pat gave me appear in this plot? And so I have a quick reference guide for myself with the PC plot hooks. And then the seventh and final thing is the plot itself, where per my usual style, I have a detailed opening. And then more kind of a templated progression of, well, if they do this, this could happen. If they do this, this could happen. Here's some characters out in the background they may or may not run into. And I just kind of see where things go. All right, but let's move on to that to talk to...
Well, hold on. 2 seconds okay. Here. As an outsider, because, you know, I've never played Battletech. And as an outsider, hearing you guys talk about this game or whatever, you know, it sounds intriguing, whatever. But, you know, I'm hearing an awful lot of whining coming from those guys. You know, it's like,
yes,
ooh, you broke
my
dropship. You know, frankly, Dan, I think you're giving them too much leeway in terms of how much success they actually have. What you need to do as a GM...
No, he's not!
What you need to do as a GM is you need to grind them down to a fine paste and then roll them up in the dropship character sheet and smoke them.
Would you like to hear how this campaign started? Because you're really, really wrong. It started with the comm call from what was left of the 3C Center saying, everyone's dead but you. What do we do now, Wayne? Like, this has been that campaign.
Well, yeah, and, you know, your father, the one who runs this, we think he's dead too.
Yeah. Now, in Dan's defense, that was our idea. Yeah. We asked for
it. No. I think this is awesome. I'm just saying, Adam, the campaign you described by which the entire PC group is kicked in the no less than once every other game. We've gone 3 sessions and 2 of them have been grinding repeated uppercuts to the nuts.
Our major victory last session when we took out the enemy, she tricked us into killing my own father and all of our people.
And yeah, but then she died.
And that, well, that was actually how she let you in, because that was the war crime you guys needed to get leverage over their pilots.
Right. Yeah. So even our victories are tinted with this huge defeat and loss. Yeah.
See, there's something that I'm going to link in the show notes just because it's funny. It's offensive, but it's funny, which is kind of what I'm hearing Adam say that I need to be using here. There's something on the Boondocks called the Pimp's Prayer.
Yeah.
I'm just going to link this to the show. You can listen to it yourself, but it sounds like what Adam's saying, mm-hmm, is that a GM, I need to get my pimp hand stronger.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I think you do.
Yeah, that one game where we won was just too much.
And won at the cost of Wayne's father and all that.
And, you know, two-thirds of the mechs and four out of the five vehicles and the dropship the first time.
Yeah. Well, from what you guys are talking about around the table for the first part of this episode is you'll love it anyway because it's all about you want the defeat, so yay.
That's right. That's right.
I think you guys win.
Holy crap. Pat's here? When did that happen?
He climbed in the window.
I think when we win, we'll think we won because we obviously can lose. So I'm fine with that. And I also think it's totally our fault that we've screwed up and dropped too quick. So
yeah,
there's that.
Mm-hmm.
I still say that victory should just be so, so rare that you're like, wait, did we just win? How did we just win?
So
possible.
Wait. I think that we should have a BattleTech campaign, not a Chicago Cubs campaign.
I
mean,
I think it should be
tomato.
It should be like victory, but at what cost? Sort of thing.
That was the victory.
Yeah.
There's been one victory, but at what cost? And two defeats. So the scoreboard's looking like the Cubs at this point.
Okay.
Best game ever.
Yeah, and we're all having a blast.
Yeah. Not as big a blast as the dropship had, though.
No, that dropship was going to have a much bigger blast if someone didn't heat up to 27 and wasn't able to get out of the way, Chad.
All righty. So, Adam, the reason that you are on this show, outside of the fact that you're like Chad's binky.
He's big and he's soft.
Called worse.
Oh, yeah.
And you Chad said he was him? Coming back Man. Onto the show, but he had to
no,
bring
that's
you
Keith
with
Bird.
You shot me a PM on the forum where we were talking about introducing people to setting. This was just a couple episodes back, a couple regular episodes back, that is. And you said, you know, hey, I'd love to come on the show and talk a little bit about that. And I kind of kicked it back and said, well, we kind of just did. I mean, is there an angle you have in mind here that we didn't cover? And you replied and actually did have an angle we didn't cover. Now, do you want to set this up or do you want me to?
No, I can do it.
Okay, go ahead.
The biggest angle that, you know, you guys have talked a lot about getting people into the hobby in the first place, you know, doing the legwork or whatever involved. And not that there's a lot, but you have to make the effort because this is a hobby that's not terribly well self-sustaining because it's not something that lends itself very well to just random people showing up and starting to do it. Not like a pickup game of like baseball or something like that.
Right.
What I wanted to talk about was, okay, so you've got your first time player. They're hooked. They want to play. How do you introduce them into the game, taking something like an established setting or an established system, and explain it to them without overwhelming them, without inundating them with information and making their heads explode, and without basically turning them off in the first 15, 20 minutes with just this barrage of information? What advice can we give to the listeners who are introducing these people to the game for the first time as to how exactly they can do that without making that person's brain hurt?
Yeah. Just tell the characters that they can do anything and introduce systems as they're necessary to resolve actions.
And then destroy their dropship. There were, as we were kicking this back and forth, I came up with four basic things. We talked about how do you give someone a detailed setting without breaking their brains. But with a brand new player, you've got four things you've got to accomplish. One, get them comfortable with the entire idea of gaming. Two, teach the setting. Three, help them make a character and learn how to operate a character. And then fourth, help them understand the rules at least well enough to get what the numbers on the page mean. And you must do these four things without overwhelming them. When we talked about setting, that is one of the four things. Here you've got four tasks. Now, with that said, actually, I'm going to push this over to Wayne. Wayne, when we brought you into the group, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? What would you do if tomorrow you were to bring Wayne Part 2 into this group?
Well, it was a bit of a weird case because going in, I had printed out all of the stuff from the website that wasn't at all the system that we were running, but the backstory was still there.
Right.
So I kind of knew what was going on with Skies of Glass going in. I think it helped that we did the character creation the way we did. We weren't gaming that week. It was just you and me going through character creation, then we got comfortable doing board games that week because we were missing a couple of players for some reason. So it was nice to just sit down, here's how character creation works, here's how this process works, and it kind of let a little bit off there. Starting the next week in the game, if it would have been straight to me to do something, I would have had no clue what to do and seized up. I do think that in those first couple games, definitely forcing me to make decisions or say things or put the spotlight on me was good. But also just watching everyone else for the first few minutes as things get rolling to kind of see, oh, that's how this works. Because I had no clue. I had no clue at all what to expect sitting down that first game.
Yeah.
And no matter
how...
You were
missing the basic concepts.
Yes, no matter how simple a system is, when you have no basis for the system, when you've never heard the term 1D20, you know, 2D6, when you sit down and everyone's like, oh, it's real simple, and they start going through the rules, all of this terminology is so new. And you kind of get focused on that initially, too. You know, well, I want to know, what can I do on this sheet? That was one of the biggest things to, I think, to break was I thought I could only do the things listed on the sheet.
There's also social conventions that we as role players take for granted that somebody who's never done this before doesn't even understand.
Like wash with soap. Oh, wait, that's not one.
No, it isn't sometimes.
That was a big thing. Like, yeah. When can I talk?
Yeah, who do we take turns? Do we raise our hands? Do we all just sit here and contribute something at the beginning, and then the game master tells us the story?
Do John and Chad overwhelm the PCs while Dan dictates the action? Because I think that's a fine way to run a game.
I don't have a problem.
We're good every Sunday.
I mean, Lost is a dropship, but we're having fun. So.
I mean, and how much joking around the table is okay? That was a big one.
You have to keep your pants on?
No.
No.
Not on my online Pathfinder
game. Pat cleared that one up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But yeah, those Pat came down in the robe that one time.
That was really what I remember more than anything else, wasn't getting stuck on the setting, because the setting actually came very quickly. It was more the generics of how do I do this?
What Why is everyone else doing? So quickly? Was it just those documents?
I don't think it was just the documents. I think it was just a matter of the setting we were playing in wasn't something like Battletech. Battletech is a first game. I think I would have had a lot harder time with the setting. We were set in a city that I was intimately aware of. I know Cape Girardeau. We were playing in a future version of Cape Girardeau.
A wrecked, trash Cape Girardeau,
yes.
But it's still...
So, Cape Girardeau. Cape Girardeau.
Cape Girardeau, yeah, it still exists.
There was still that level of familiarity.
Rush Limbaugh.
And really, yes, settings can be vast, huge. In Battletech right now, I've got no clue a lot of the setting things. But I've come to realize over the years of gaming now that it's not really that big of a deal to not have that bigger picture.
It's especially fine in Battletech because... no one has the bigger picture.
Yeah. A lot of times, if you just get the small picture of here's how everyone works with each other around the table, that's all I really need to kind of jump in. And if I screw something up with the setting, Dan will let me know. And it's like, oh, okay, well, I didn't say that. I say this.
In preparation for this episode, and I almost never prepare for episodes, so you guys feel all special and stuff. But in preparation for this episode, I came up with kind of 3 points about, you know, a good ways to go about this. And that's actually one of my points.
Wait a minute. You brought a numbered list to Fear the Boot.
God bless you.
I brought an unnumbered list to Fear
the Boot. Okay, man, now I'm nervous. Last time I was on an episode with you where you took the time to do numbered lists, have this nice organization, we lost the audio, and it was one of the best pieces of podcasting I've ever been involved with. So now I'm nervous.
We got most of it back on the Chris's Pumpkin episode, but not all of it.
All right, so
Adam, what's your numbered list?
Adam, go ahead.
Okay, so the one that Wayne is talking about here is finding a commonality, finding a common ground. Part of what helped Wayne with the setting is that he already kind of knew the setting. You know, he knows what that, whatever the hell city you just were talking about.
Cape Girardeau.
Cape Girardeau, yes.
Sure, okay.
I can imagine what it would look like with a nuclear bomb dropped on it.
Not much.
It wasn't nuked, it was abandoned.
Anyway, so find a common ground. You know, if you're playing in a post-apocalyptic world, it helps to set it in a setting that you're familiar with. Like if, you know, you live in New York or whatever, set it in New York. If you, you know, have traveled to New York a lot, that kind of thing. If it's something completely fantastic like Battletech or a fantasy setting, find, you know, the themes of the setting, and with a new player, just kind of compare it to that. Like if you're just playing generic D&D, ask them if they've read Lord of the Rings. Because that's basically what D&D is. At least they have that basis. At least they have that kind of common ground to jump off from. The first thing I ask anybody who's starting, and I should give you a little bit of background here. I game with predominantly girls, and most of them I introduce to the hobby.
I miss those days.
Yeah, Chad, our gaming group was majority women for years.
Yes.
This is the first time I've ever had a woman in our group regularly.
Yeah, and we have one.
Yeah.
Sausage Party plus Beth. Though actually my Saturday gaming group, that one is, if it's not predominantly female, it's 50-50. because I've got Carla and both of my sisters on it.
You're 50-50.
So,
I am running one horror game that I've just introduced the other male into right now.
I can just imagine. And ladies, you're in the club, you're having fun, and it's a guy! Oh,
no! So, Adam, something else you said there that actually thinking about my Saturday group feeds into. You talked about finding that commonality. That commonality, it could be a city, it could be a cultural reference, but depending on the setting, it could even just be a genre or well-established intellectual property. When I started running a Star Trek game, even my sisters, who are not by any stretch of the imagination geeks, they knew what Star Trek was. They understood what a Klingon was. They understood what it meant to go to warp speeds. Battletech, yes, this is a much more complex and obscure setting, but there are a ton of settings you can grab where, hey, look, even in D&D, it was Forgotten Realms. But because of Tolkien and all that sort of stuff, they understood what an elf was. They understood what a dwarf was. I did have to explain what a Balenorn was, but even then, there was...
I don't even know what that is.
I have no idea what that is.
It's a, it's an undead and typically good-aligned lich.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds dumb.
I've used those before.
No, actually, they're really kind of a neat concept, but...
They are.
The point being, though, that one, by the time we got...
Manual.
By the time we got to it, I was at least able to... context it within setting they understood. So I'm sorry, though. With that said, please continue.
The commonality doesn't necessarily even have to be all the things that we've already talked about. It can be a point in history that the setting is similar to, such as the Eberron campaign setting is very, very similar in both technology and political climate as Europe and the Americas post-World War I. And if anybody has any world history at all, they can kind of relate to that. I mean, you know, there's trains, there's airships, there's all that stuff. That's just there. People can kind of get that frame of reference. So it's really just trying to find what works for that player. You know, I mean, if they're a history buff or whatever, making that World War I reference works. They've read a lot of Tolkien and read a lot of, you know, sci-fi fantasy, making that works. It's really just, you know, as a GM working with a new player to figure out what thing will make it click for them, what will make it happen for them. For Wayne, it's the fact that he lives kind of nearby, he knows the city, he picked up the history documents and read them, you know, and that worked for him, and that's fantastic. But the first question I ever ask is, what kind of learner are you?
Ooh, that's a good one. Yeah.
Some people learn by reading. Some people learn by lecture. Some people learn by a combination of both.
Some people learn by doing. I'm the latter. If I'm starting a new setting, I don't know. I mean, I want a little bit of context, but beyond that, I'd rather just get in there and figure it out. Ask a lot of questions as I go.
That's how I want to learn a system. I cannot learn a system by reading a book. I want to get in and actually start using it, and that's how I teach myself the system.
That's you and me, Wayne. I can't learn a system by just reading the book. I have to learn it by doing, which is part of the reason, as you know, the primary GM for our group right now, part of the reason why we haven't branched out to any other systems is because I can't pick up a damn book and read it. So, and that's a really, really important question to learn, because if you start lecturing to somebody that learns better by reading, it's just going to go in one ear and out the other. And they're going to be sitting there, you know, in the game just going, God, this guy's pedantic. Why is he still talking? You know, and that's no good. So yeah. If they learn by reading, hand them a damn book. Maybe guide them where they're going or whatever. I mean, if there's written context, I mean, obviously, if it's a homebrew game, you know, there may not be much, but, you know, hand them something and say, okay, well, here's where you want to start, here's you want to go, so on and so forth. So that's really the first question I ever ask a new player.
I think the hard part with that question is, within a group, you can have people that learn different ways, and yep. You've got to find that happy balance. If one of them is someone that needs the lecture, how do you give them the lecture there without boring the person that needs the book?
Generally, I hand them the book and give the other person the lecture. That's usually how I do it. Well, here's the thing. With new players in particular, like new players to the hobby entirely, generally I find that doing either a group or a one-on-one character creation is a good thing. You know, say that you're going to meet at every Tuesday in game. The first session is not a gaming session, but it's a sit-down. You talk about group template. You talk about who's going to kind of do what and what roles you want to fill if you want to go that route. I mean, my players kind of go all everywhere. Some just kind of build what they want, and others just kind of go, oh, wait and see what the rest of the party does. I find that that really helps, particularly if you have a new player, because, you know, as me as the GM, if I'm helping somebody else with something with their character, one of the other players who has a little bit more experience with the system or whatever can jump in and answer any questions that this new player might have. And maybe they have a way to relate to that person more so than I do, or they have a different way to do it, and they just, for whatever reason, that clicks. And I find that doing that kind of group character creation really, really helps new players figure out what the heck they're doing and feel like they're part of the group.
Yeah, I think that that's really important when introducing a new player in, is that you really have to let them have a buy-in, whether it's on a micro level where they invent part of the world or whatever, or they invent some part of the team, or they come to the table with some sort of foreknowledge. Not that they are subject matter experts on the gaming system and the world and what's going on, but before the game even starts, they're there trying to figure out what is this role-playing concept. And they're trying to figure out all the stuff that we try and figure out with a new group. What's the group dynamic? What are the social rules? The awkward first games as the characters try to interact and figure out what the social rules are, what we're doing.
I had so many questions. But you want to have even imagine trying to have come to that first game without having listened to episode 115.
Yeah.
I listened to that episode multiple times, and that's why I went in knowing at least, okay, here's some basic terminology. Here's a description of kind of what could happen. I had no idea what it would be like sitting around the table or any of that, but at least some of that basic concepts were done very well in 115. I talk about that all the time. And I hate to sound like I'm gushing about a podcast that I'm on now, but
go ahead.
That really was an incredibly valuable tool for me, at least. I give it out all the time because it does explain the concepts in multiple ways that are easy to understand.
Well, and I think therein lies a couple pieces of advice. I'm going to draw together some things Adam said, some things Wayne said. Wayne, let me start with something you said, which is talking about the background documents you were reading, episode 115, et cetera, et cetera. There's a really important thing there. I think the more time you give the person to prepare for it, I mean, within reason, the better. In your case, you're able to listen to that episode, read those documents. But even, let's say, it's not someone who's going to listen to Fear the Boot. You can still have conversations with them where you kind of slowly ease them into the idea of gaming. When they come to the gaming table, you stress to them again and again and again, you don't need to understand all of this. Don't hesitate to ask questions. And heck, pause the game every so often to explain things, even if they didn't ask a question. You give them the sense that they have time to figure this out. You know, let them ease into that. The other thing that I'd say, kind of going back to something that Adam was talking about, is let me use the analogy of a restaurant you want to introduce someone to. If I'm trying to convince Carla to come with me and try a restaurant I really like, but she's never been to before, I have to make sure that there is something on the menu that's going to appeal to her. I have to talk about the parts of the menu that she's going to be interested in. The difference between a restaurant and a role-playing game is in a restaurant, you all have your own meals. In role-playing games, you're all eating the same meal. Mm-hmm. You are all playing the same game. And so I think there might be a virtue. And if you are really interested in getting someone interested in the hobby and making sure they are comfortable coming into it, you may have to let their tastes carry more weight than the other people at the table.
You know, you got me thinking something you said earlier, too, about, you know, you have to ease the player in, you have to do that. I think you can coddle a player too much.
Yes, balance it all things.
And I think that it's really helpful for a new player on their first game to shove them into a role-playing situation to get them to where either you have another player who's kind of on board with you and you say, hey, start role-playing with this guy. I want them to kind of get a taste. Or you have an NPC and you put them in a situation where they role-play, they use their skills, they roll some dice, they see the results of what happened. And, you know, you have like a mini encounter that kind of circles around them. And it doesn't necessarily even have to be about them, but it just gives them a taste that you put the spotlight on them.
I'm going to agree with you, Chad, but conditionally.
I'm used to it.
That's not something you want to do in the first 15 minutes.
No. Yeah, I would let them observe.
Let them watch other people. Yeah. And one other thing I think we should mention, we keep talking about easing people in, you know, how do you explain things to them? It sounds like we're suggesting everything here is a really difficult concept.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's scary. No, it's just socially awkward.
Well, not even that. I want to point out that these are fairly simple concepts, but for someone who's never gamed, they're foreign concepts.
That's what I was going to say, is they appear difficult and impenetrable.
Yes. That's the big thing you have to remember as you're going into this. Yes, it may be a very simple concept, but it's a foreign concept. And we could treat it the same way as you would a difficult concept you're trying to introduce someone to. But for someone new coming in, they may feel initially, I'm behind the curve. I'm feeling really stupid because I'm not getting this. Everyone's talking about how simple of concept this is. In reality, it's not a difficult concept or anything like that. It's just foreign. It's something you've never been exposed to.
Drawing on a couple of different points here, we're kind of verging on my last point on my list, which is you learn by doing. Ultimately, you know, you can, even if you do read the book or you learn by reading or learn by lecture or whatever, ultimately, you're going to have to do it. You got to jump in with both feet, whatever. You just got to do it because unless you do, it doesn't count. I have used episode 115 to kind of explain to people what the hobby is and to kind of quantify that. I use a little bit more sparingly just because it's hard to explain. Okay, this is an episode of a podcast I listen to, and a lot of my friends are like, what the hell is a podcast? I'm like, that thing I do every week. Never mind. Anyway.
Well, no, that's actually one reason why when I give it out, I never give out the audio files. I actually have some burnt discs of it. I give them a CD, because then they don't have to understand two concepts that they're not familiar with, because everyone's familiar with a CD, whether they're familiar with the podcast or not.
True.
Oh, here's a audio disc explaining how to do this. I get that.
So let me give you an example of what not to do with a new player for the first time.
Slap them in the face.
No, that's okay.
Oh, no, that was our Battletech game we're playing now. I'm sorry.
I have a young lady that I introduced to the hobby as kind of a favor for a buddy of mine. Not that I had an issue with it, because she's just this absolutely amazing girl, but I introduced her to the hobby and kind of brought her in, and she picked it up really quickly, and I was really, you know, really happy with how she picked it up, and she was building a lot of different characters all at once, because we have a lot of games going on. I was telling Dan about this a while ago. We have something like 12 games going on at one time here, but she was building a whole bunch of different characters. What I didn't realize is that when I was putting her into this game, this is the first time she was really, really going to be playing in a regular, consistent game ever. And what I wound up doing is I had her jump into the role. She joined an existing game, and I had her jump into a role of the girlfriend of one of the PCs with a very deeply kinky and sexual relationship. She's big into theater, and she's really okay with it, but...
I was going to ask one question. Is she okay with this?
She was fine. She, you know, she rolled with it, but this was the first time, like...
Is she a method actress?
I have absolutely no comments on that one.
You will have to be on Kicked in the Dice Bags. That is where we talk about these things.
Yes, that's where we talk about method acting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I realized... Actually, as we were talking about this about 10 minutes ago, that her first real, like, ongoing gaming experience has been this character who's this deeply sexual, deeply involved with another one of the other PCs, actually the very same guy that they kind of introduced her to me. And I'm like, wow, I really, really probably shouldn't have done that. So yeah, that's an example of what not to do to new players. Now she's swinging, she's going with it. She seems to be fine with it. There's a little bit of friction.
You were about to say she's swinging.
Yeah,
with it.
I liked your first verb choice there.
I bet she is.
She's going with it. She seems to be doing okay. We'll see. There's been a little bit of tension, but there's always a little bit of tension when you introduce a new character into an already established group. So we'll see how things go. We're going to have our second game probably this Tuesday, a week from today. So
got a little bit of group friction going on there?
Only in the greatest way possible. We don't role play. We orgy all Tuesday. Hey, Dan, can I say vagina boob on your podcast?
Yeah, you can. You can say anything on here that can be said on primetime television, I believe. Yes, I know they can, because actually in the Family Guy episode where they were spoofing Shawshank Redemption.
That's where I got that from.
I think that's what Peter Griffin said.
Vagina boob?
Yeah, I said vagina boob. It was quite some time before he said two words to me. Vagina boob.
There is a little segue or a little tangent here. There is a side project that I cropped together on Kick to the Dice Bags of a session that we had actually recorded, because one of my guys was actually he was in a transcription class, talking about transcripts. He was in a transcription class and he wanted to record a role-playing session and transcript 5 minutes of it. So I was determined every 5 minutes. Transcript is the wrong verb. But anyway.
I think transcribe is what you're looking for.
Transcribe is what I'm looking for.
Transcriptify.
Transcriptify.
Transcriptulate.
Transcriptulatorium.
Anyway, so he was going to transcribe 5 minutes of the game. So I was bound and determined every 5 minutes to say the term vagina boob. So it would have to be his college level project. So anyway, what we wound up doing is we recorded this, you know, four or five hour session. And what I did was I went through every single one of those hours and cut out every single funny quip or whatever, including every single vagina boob, and put it together in a kind of a laugh track.
You know what we're going to do now? We're getting transcripts done. I'm going to have to start using like Welsh words.
what's that impronounceable, unspellable volcano that erupted in Iceland? You're going to have to figure out how to say it and say it.
I think, though, really the kind of punchline I would put on this whole thing is, look, you introduce people to gaming the same way you would introduce them to any other hobby. It's just, as Wayne noted, this will appear much more foreign to them because they may lack a lot of frame of reference for it. And so the more context you can provide them through familiar mm-hmm. settings, through simple ideas, the better. And just know the person. I mean, know what kinds of things they're into. Know what kinds of characters they're going to like. Know what their learning style is. And do whatever you can to make them feel as comfortable as possible. And you will get them through the process. And, you know, Wayne, how many games in was it before you really felt comfortable with gaming as a concept?
Didn't take very long at all. Two or three games.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind
of... After the initial hazing and red alerts, well,
and that's
jumped right in.
Kind of been my observation, like looking at my current Star Trek game. There's a bunch of people there that are first-time gamers. And some of them kind of did the Wayne thing. One of them took the entire cadet orientation source book and photocopied it, mostly so they'd have a proper noun reference. So if I said, hey, you meet an Orion, they could flip over and read what Orion is real mm-hmm. quick. But it's the same thing of, you know, I think within a matter of just a couple games, they all seem pretty comfortable with it. Sure, they may not have totally understood the character sheets or all the detailed concepts, but they understood things well enough to kind of fumble their way around, and they weren't afraid of it. They weren't intimidated by it anymore. You know, it was something that they felt good about doing. And I was careful as a GM to focus on things like the story and the role-playing and such. So there were things they could walk away feeling like, yeah, I got something out of this. Even if I didn't follow any of the rules and didn't get all the proper nouns, there was this moment where we had these interactions. And that's human. That's storytelling. And that they immediately latched on to.
And it helps to have someone like Chad in the group who doesn't care about the rules or any of that and has mm-hmm. no idea what the rules are either.
I guess Chad is liberating in sort of a nudist kind of mm-hmm. way.
Has no idea how many hit points the dropship's armor has.
Not until he told me. We all, John, to segue into that, John, you said it best. We all thought it was huge, but instead it was just kind of a lot.
Yeah.
Alrighty, well, I want to remind you guys one last time about the video game giveaway. That will be going on through October 23rd, which is a Sunday. That Monday morning, I will run a script to pick the winners. So you have until the end of that Sunday per Central Time USA.
I've played the demos of all of those games except one. They're all pretty good.
And I've got several more. There's actually a total of about 10 of these games. I've got a bunch
Could you say that there's maybe instead of five of those games and... nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
There's
I own an
a
Xbox,
bunch of download codes for the arcade. So
I've got, really?
Yes. Texhope does not,
Would
man.
You say that you have five?
of a bunch, codes? Like half of a bunch?
So if you've not already and you are interested in those, once again, don't be a douche and enter for games you don't want or just going to eBay or something. But if you're interested in any of those games, be sure to get out there, follow the links in the show notes and get entered for those. Adam, I want to thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
For anyone who's not familiar with them already, you might want to go check out Kicked in the Dice Bags.
My other show.
I'll link that in the show notes, a place where Chad, like a cheap harlot, goes and cheats on us.
That's right. And it's so dirty.
Actually, I think everyone here has been with Kicked in the Dice Bags.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. We've all had
of you war.
Hey, it's not me. It's Keith, I swear.
Well, and we're working right now on scheduling.
Keith is a whore. That's why I like him.
To get probably one of the most referenced and never appearing persons on this podcast. I'm trying to get Chris Mace on here for a show coming up.
But the last time we did, it broke.
I know. The podcast couldn't handle it.
It's his show. Kicked in the Dice Bag is his show. And we invite him to be on his show all the time. We include him in all the emails talking about his show all the time.
Every damn week. And yes. I don't think he's only showed up to like two.
Yeah.
You know what's hilarious to me? I've been on two regular episodes of the new Kicked in the Dice Bags, one side project, and one of the original format when it was just Chris and Jonathan.
Yeah.
I have never been on with Chris. I've talked to him plenty of times. I've interacted with him plenty of times.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think I've ever been on a recording
with Chris. Talking about Fear the Con, I think more than anything else, I may be looking forward to the final installment of the Blaxploitation
trilogy. I have
trilogy.
Got to get in on Lord Lordy, Almighty, there'll be cotton on the moon.
Lordy, Lordy, there'll be cotton on the moon. So, anyway, thank you guys for tuning in. You guys have a great week, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Hear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.